First, the entire universe seemed to explode in a blaze of force. From the hyperdimensional non-space through which they had been traveling, Kane, Domi, and Grant fell through one bottomless abyss after another. There was a micro-instant of non-existence, then a sharp, wrenching shock, and their senses returned. Kane stared up at the pattern of hexagonal silver discs on the ceiling and realized the gateway transit had been successful. Trying to focus through the last of the mist wisping over his eyes, Kane silently endured the nausea churning and rolling in his stomach. He knew if he waited it out, he wouldn't vomit, but it would take another minute to regain his emotional equilibrium. No human being, no matter how thoroughly briefed in advance, could expect to remain unflappable on a hyperdimensional trip through the Mattrans gateway. By stepping into the armaglass-enclosed chamber, 1 second a person was in the relativistic here, surrounded by glowing mist, and in the next second, all eternity seemed to cave in. Perceptions changed, time jumped, and for a heart-stopping instant, the cosmos at large seemed to stand still. Then the traveler was wherever the transmitter had been programmed to send him or her. Whatever else, a trip through the gateway was unsettling to the mind, to the nerves, and to the soul itself, as Kane had personal reason to know. Still, the overland journey from Ragnarville to the rendezvous near Redoubt Tango had been far more unpleasant. All four people were keyed up, tense and on edge. Ayn refused to answer any questions about Vend or the Millennial Consortium. All she did was cry and tell whoever spoke to her to go to hell. Kane couldn't really blame her, despite doubting the depth of her love for Vend. Regardless of whether the girl had truly been devoted to the man, the circumstances of his death evoked too many unpleasant memories of a similar incident well over a year ago when he shot and killed a woman whom he perceived was threatening Bridget Baptiste. But in this case, although he felt he hadn't been given much choice in the matter, he also felt he had been maneuvered into acting as assassin. The route to meet Alf Thoraldson was over exceptionally rugged terrain. Although Minnesota had been spared direct strikes during the nuclear conflagration of 2 centuries before, Skydark had turned the state into a virtual deep freeze covering 100,000 square miles. Redoubt Tango itself was located about 35 miles to the southwest of Ragnarville. Fittingly, the Tango installation had served as a research center into new forms of applications of cryonic science. Thoraldson and his roamers had agreed to wait for them a few miles north of the redoubt. The roamers knew the installation existed, but they didn't know how to overcome the security lock and enter the place. Grant and Kane felt it would be tactically unwise to let them in on the secret. When the Sandcat topped a rise, Grant pointed out 2 fires burning in the post-dawn dark, providing the only light on the dark plain. A group of people moved between the fires, trying to keep themselves warm in the below-freezing temperatures. A makeshift corral had been erected near the site containing a remuda of about 2 dozen horses. An old pickup truck was parked near them. At the sight and sound of the Sandcat's approach, no one in the camp ran, but the men all formed a fairly impressive skirmish line, brandishing a variety of weapons from simple spears to rifles. Alf Thoraldson's roamer gang wasn't quite as barbaric and wild-looking as some they had encountered, but they were a rough-looking crowd nevertheless, bearded, wild-haired, wearing a variety of rags, furs, and even cloaks crudely cut and stitched from carpets. All of them had the same feral, predatory look as Leloup Garou's band of roamers Kane and Grant had caused to be buried beneath a C4-triggered avalanche a couple of years before. Born into a raw, wild world, roamers were accustomed to living on the edge of death. Grim necessity had taught them the skills to survive, even thrive in the post-nuke environment. They may have been the great-great-great-grandchildren of civilized men and women, but they had no choice but to embrace lives of semi-barbarism. Thoraldson himself apparently set the fashion standard. A man of about the same height and build as Grant, he was a few years older. A dark blonde beard clothed the lower half of his face. A medal of polished iron inscribed with indecipherable runes hung from his right ear, stretching out the lobe. His buckskin tunic and leggings were fringed and beaded. A long-handled tomahawk hung from his wide belt, and riding high on his right hip was a Sig Sauer P226 pistol. Neither Grant nor Kane could even guess at where the man might have found such an unusual handgun. Dangling from a leather tie attached to the bottom of the holster were human scalps, the hair of all textures and colors. Kane counted 7 of them. As Grant and Kane disembarked, Thorolson regarded them dispassionately with hooded, heavy-lidded eyes. His face and hands were covered by a network of old scar tracings, mementos from his lifelong war against nature, against hardship, and the forces of the Vills. His eyes held the pale gray color of ice, and their frostiness did not thaw even when Ein climbed out of the sandcat and approached him. Without preamble, Thorolson spoke up.
"You brought her back just like you said. You get to keep your heads."
Kane sensed Grant tensing up, due to apprehension or anger, but he chose not to respond, either verbally or with a show of weapons. Ein stood before her father, head bowed, but the expression on her face was anything but contrite. Putting one blunt, crooked finger under her chin, Thorolson lifted the girl's head so she stared directly into his eyes. They gazed at each other in silence for a long moment. Then Thorolson whipped his hand from beneath her chin and slapped her face. She went staggering toward a fire. Kane lunged forward, catching the girl before she fell into it. He glared at Thorolson.
"I can't say much for the Romer welcome home customs."
The man's bewhiskered lips curled in a sneer.
"Don't interfere, Sekman."
Kane felt the back of his neck heating with a flush of anger. Sekman was an obsolete term dating back to pre-unification days, when self-styled barons formed their own private armies to safeguard their territories. It was still applied to magistrates in the far hinterlands beyond the Vills, mainly by roamers and farers.
"Don't give me orders, you lying slag-ass bastard."
Ein Thorolson jerked away from Kane's touch as if his hands contaminated her. Rubbing the reddened side of her face, she stumbled toward a knot of people. A middle-aged woman reached out for her, enfolding her in her arms and hustling her away.
"What do you mean by calling me a liar? Speak up!"
It required a conscious effort of will on Kane's part to keep from drawing his pistol and planting a bullet in the man's forehead. He might not have been a magistrate any longer, but his ingrained mag pride was offended by the roamer's arrogance. He felt the old magistrate's sense of righteous superiority rise up in him.
"Don't call me a sect man."
Thorolson's frosty eyes darted from Kane to Grant. Both of them kept their weapons leathered, but the roamer chieftain knew such a condition could be reversed in an eye blink. He nodded brusquely.
"Fair enough, but you called me a liar."
"Actually, my exact words were lying, slag-ass bastard. But I suppose we can split the difference, since you probably know who your daddy was."
"You have any idea of how close to death you are?"
"Actually, I think that should be my line."
He gestured with his left hand, and the topside bubble turret of the Sandcat revolved, the perforated barrel of one of the big USMG-73s aligning itself with Thorolson's upper body. Domi's white-haired head was barely visible behind the armaglass. Thorolson's eyes flickered briefly with surprise, then anger, which was quickly veiled. Hooking his thumbs into his belt, he rocked lightly on the balls of his feet.
"So Ein told you she hadn't been kidnapped?"
"And that she was married."
"And what did that little mucksucker Vend have to say for himself?"
"Not much. I shot him before we could talk."
"The little prick is dead. Thanks, Kane. You're back in my good graces again."
"Yeah, but you top our shit list, shithead. What's the real story?"
Thorolson shrugged.
"The Millennial Consortium approached me about a year ago, wanting my permission to dig around in some old caves and Indian mounds. Their barter was good, so I let them. Then one of them got too friendly with Ein."
"Vend."
"Vend. I told the kid's section chief, a hard case named Snow, that the deal was off and to haul his ass out of there."
"But instead, Vend hauled ass to Ragnarville with Ein. The consortium told you that unless you left them alone, you'd never see her again."
Thorolson nodded.
"That's about the general shape and size of it. I had my own plans for the girl. I promised her hand in marriage to Old DeMiro. She didn't like the idea, and that's why she ran off with Vend."
"Who's Old DeMiro?"
"Chief of the Thief River Falls Roamers. Ein's been betrothed to him since she was 8.
Kane shook his head in disgust.
"So you just used us so we'd fetch her back against her will and arrange for a pretty terminal annulment from Vend. My lying slag-ass bastard comment still stands, you lying slag-ass bastard."
Thorolson's eyes flashed with sudden fury.
"My daughter ain't got no right to do what she done. As for using you to bring her back, what the fuck are you planning for me and mine but to use us?"
Kane struggled to tamp down his own rising rage.
"To act as intermediaries, not as assassins. That's what the fuck we're planning."
which I already took care of with old DeMiro. Now he owes you too. Everybody got what they wanted, so you got no call to get on the muscle with me.
Kane bit back a profane comeback, realizing with a sickening sense of humiliation that the Roamer chieftain was right. Even though he and his friends had been played and used as pawns, the mission objective had been reached.
Where are the millennialists operating?
Thorldson gestured vaguely southward.
Some place called Carver's Cave.
What are they doing there?
I don't know. They didn't tell me. Paid me not to ask. So what about our business? What do you want my clan to do?
Kane inhaled a deep breath, wincing slightly as the chill air bit at his lips.
Spread the word among all Roamer clans. Cerberus wants to be afforded safe passage through all of their territories.
What? What the hell does that mean?
It means that if Roamers see strangers in their territories, particularly if they're in vehicles, they are not to attack them. If they identify themselves as being from Cerberus, then they're to be allowed to pass unmolested.
I see. Deal.
He thrust out his right hand, and after a thoughtful few seconds, Kane took it, stoically enduring the painful, crushing pressure the Roamer chief applied to it. He took Grant's hand, and Kane saw Thorldson grimace when he tried the same trick and instead had it done to him. Thorldson swept his frosty gaze over Kane and Grant.
You have my word.
Kane didn't ask him further questions about the Millennial Consortium or Carver's Cave. He was by now accustomed to the frustration of dealing with mysteries on an almost daily basis. One mystery that had never been solved was how someone could begin a Mattran's journey standing up and almost always end it by lying on their back. Kane turned his head to look at the armorglass walls. These were colored a rich earth-brown tone, not red, so he knew the jump from Redoubt Tango was successful. No matter how many gateway transits he had made in the past 2+ years, he was always pleasantly surprised when he realized he was still alive and whole. Intellectually, he knew the Mattran's energies transformed organic and inorganic matter to digital information, transmitted it through a hyperdimensional quantum path, and reassembled it in a receiver unit. Emotionally, the experience felt like a fleeting brush with death, or worse than death. It was non-existence, at least for a nanosecond of time. Often, the only way a jumper could be sure a transit had been initiated at all was by the color of the armorglass walls. All of the official Cerberus gateway units in the Mattrans network were color-coded, so authorized jumpers could tell at a glance into which redoubt they had materialized. Despite the fact it seemed an inefficient method of differentiating one installation from another, only personnel holding color-coded security clearances were allowed to make use of the system. Inasmuch as their use was restricted to a select few of the units, it was fairly easy for them to memorize which color designated what redoubt. Domian Grant stirred on the floor plates as Kane pushed himself up, leaning against the wall. Grant levered himself to his feet, swaying on unsteady legs before straightening. He extended a hand to Domi, who affected not to notice it as she rose.
I hope Bridget has gotten the new interphaser working. Traveling by that spoils you for the Mattrans.
Well, she said it was ready to be tested before we left.
The heavy slab of armorglass swung open on counterbalanced hinges, and Kane stepped down from the elevated platform and stared directly into the hollow bore of a subgun held by Lakesh. The weapon Lakesh sighted down was one of the small SA-80 subguns from the armory. All of the Cerberus exiles were required to become reasonably proficient with firearms, and the lightweight point-and-shoot subguns were the easiest for the firearm-challenged to handle. He lowered the SA-80 immediately upon recognizing the three people. They weren't surprised to be greeted by a gun. After the Mad McCann's murderous incursion into the redoubt, it had become standard protocol to have an armed guard standing by during a gateway materialization. Domi stepped down from the elevated platform and embraced Lakesh tightly. He hugged her in return, placing the SA-80 on the long table which served as the ready room's sole piece of furniture.
Missed you.
Likewise, darlingest one.
He stroked the back of her head, then his nose wrinkled.
You smell like smoke. And is your hair burned?
The girl pushed away from him, touching the browned tips of her hair.
Got a little singed in Ragnarville.
Both of us did.
Lakesh's eyes widened, and he took Domi by the shoulders, turning her this way and that, examining her.
You're not hurt, are you?
No, we're not.
Glancing his way, Lakesh smiled crookedly at Kane's sarcasm.
What was the outcome of the mission, friend Kane?
Kane shrugged out of his jacket.
We broke even, as usual. Learned a few interesting tidbits, but other than that, we had no big wins, no big losses.
As they started toward the operations center, Lakesh's shoulders sagged.
We might be facing rather big losses here.
The comment stopped Grant and Kane in their tracks. They turned to face Lakesh, eyes quizzical and troubled.
What do you mean by that?
Brigid, Brewster Filboid, and Nora Penick are missing.
Missing? From where and how?
From here. But we know where they were 3 days ago.
3 days? They've been missing for 3 days?
Lakesh only nodded.
Where were they 3 days ago?
Cambodia.
Cambodia? How the hell did they get there?
The interphaser. Brigid and Brewster felt the time was past for a test. They programmed an unindexed set of parallax point coordinates into its targeting computer, then left from here and materialized in Cambodia. Within a minute or so, the transponder signals simply stopped.
Stopped? Stopped how? Do you mean their life signs ceased?
From the doorway between the ready room and the command center, DeFore spoke.
We don't think it's their life signs. The biolink readings indicated the three of them were in perfect health. No stress readings, no spikes in heart rate or blood pressure. 1 second we received the telemetry, strong and clear, and in the next second, poof, gone.
Kane arched his eyebrows at the medic, not allowing the cold fingers of dread closing around his heart to be evident in his voice.
They just ceased transmitting? Or was our ability to receive the signals somehow impaired?
Lakesh shook his head.
It was more like a jar had been dropped over them, cutting off the transmissions of all three people all at the same time. There was no preliminary ebbing or a degradation in the strength of the signal.
Where's Cambodia?
Southeast Asia. Halfway around the world from here.
Why they go there?
To test the parallax points data. Benchmarking, like we've been doing for the past few months.
And you're sure the new interphaser didn't malfunction, like materializing them inside of a mountain?
Lakesh opened his mouth to reply, closed it, then shook his head in frustration.
I'm not sure of anything.
Kane said nothing, but he knew that an analogical computer built into the interphaser automatically scanned and selected vortex nodes above solid ground. The device had worked fine on all their previous phase transits. They had never materialized either in a lake or an ocean or underground. Months before, he, Brigid, and Grant had undergone several weeks of hard training in the use of the second version of the interphaser on short hops, selecting vortex points near the redoubt. Near at least in the sense that if they couldn't make the return trip through a quantum channel, they could conceivably walk back to the installation. Before the device had been destroyed on Mars, they began to make jumps very far afield from Cerberus, to the moon, and to the Australian outback. Many details of exactly how the machine worked remained mysteries to Kane, but he preferred to leave the brain-battering intricacies of quantum physics to Lakesh and Brigid. Grant was not so patient with Lakesh's admission that he had no definitive answer whether the interphaser could have been the culprit behind the jump team's disappearance. Normally phlegmatic in the face of adversity, the big man exuded agitation like an aura of static electricity.
You made the damn thing in the first place, Lakesh, just like you made the damn MAT transunits when you ran Project Cerberus. You were the first human being who was ever transmitted by the things. If you don't know everything about matter transmission and wormholes, then who the hell would?
Lakesh glared at him, swallowing down his anger. Although the aim of Project Cerberus was the conversion of matter to energy and back again by reducing organic and inorganic substances to encoded information, the primary stumbling block to actually achieving the goal was the sheer quantity of information that had to be encoded. Scientists had labored over a way to make this possible for nearly 50 years, financed by black funds funneled away from other government projects. Project Cerberus, like all the other totality concept researches, was classified above top secret. A few high government officials knew it existed, as did members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the military. The secrecy was believed to be more than important. It was considered to be almost a religion. After much research, matter transmission had been found to be absolutely impossible to achieve by the employment of relativistic physics. Only quantum physics, coupled with quantum mechanics, had made it work beyond a couple of prototypes which transported steel balls only a few feet across a room. But even those crude early models could not have functioned at all without the basic components which predated the totality concept. Lakish experienced a scientific and metaphysical epiphany and made the breakthrough. Under his guidance, the quantum interface Mattrans inducers opened a rift in the hyperdimensional quantum stream between a relativistic here and there. The Cerberus technology did more than beam matter from one spot in linear space to another. It reduced organic and inorganic material to digital information and transmitted it along hyperdimensional pathways on a carrier wave. In 1989, Lakesh had been the first successful long-distance matter transfer of a human subject, traveling 100 yards from a prototype gateway chamber to a receiving booth. That initial success was replicated many times, and with the replication came the modifications and improvements of the quantum interface Mattrans inducers, reaching the point where they were manufactured in modular form.
As I explained to you more than once, the interfacer is not a junior portable version of a Mattrans. The interfacer interacts with the energy within a naturally occurring vortex node and initiates a temporary overlapping of two dimensions. The vortex becomes an intersection point, a discontinuous quantum jump beyond relativistic space-time.
And one of those discontinuous quantum jumps dropped 3 of our people in Cambodia. Can you at least give us an idea of where in Cambodia they might be found?
Lakesh waved toward Bry at the Master Ops console.
That's what we've been trying to ascertain for days. Mr. Bry is presently coaxing the Veiler to transmit images from the vicinity of the Great Lake of Tonle Sap.
Not just coaxing. Got 'em.
Why do you think they ended up there?
We were able to correlate their biolink telemetry with the GPS aboard the ComSat, which was then bounced over to the Veiler. Besides, it's the logical destination.
How so?
Because of the Angkor Temple City, almost all holy sites of the ancient world were constructed at the intersection points of geomantic energy, vortex nodes.
Kane nodded in recollection.
Right. Not that I understand it, but I remember you talking about it.
They joined Grant at the main ops console, standing behind Bry. Kane nodded to Quavel and Mariah as he entered, although he felt the usual quiver of unease whenever he was in Quavel's company, under the scrutiny of her huge blue eyes, as chillingly placid as the surface of a frozen lake. Bry's skinny fingers played over the keyboard, inputting a numerical sequence. Across the right side of the screen scrolled a constant stream of figures, symbols, and numbers. The screen was dark, yet it swarmed with little points and pixels of brightness. Then, near the bottom edge, a curving sweep of blue-green began to appear.
They said it couldn't be done, but I done did it. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Cambodia.
Kane and Grant exchanged weary glances and headshakes. Lakesh repressed a smile. No one could really blame the man for preening a little. After all, it was his year's worth of hard work, as well as many failures, that allowed Cerberus to at long last gain control of the 2 still-functioning satellites in Earth orbit. Although most satellites had been little more than free-floating scrap metal for well over a century, Cerberus had always possessed the proper electronic ears and eyes to receive the transmissions from at least 2 of them. One was of the Vela Reconnaissance class, which carried narrow-band multispectral scanners. It could detect the electromagnetic radiation reflected by every object on Earth, including subsurface geomagnetic waves. The scanner was tied to an extremely high-resolution photographic relay system. The other satellite to which the redoubt was uplinked was a ComSat, which for many months was used primarily to keep track of Cerberus personnel by their subcutaneous transponders when they were out of the field. Everyone in the installation had been injected with the transponders, which transmitted heart rate, respiration, blood count, and brainwave patterns. Based on organic nanotechnology, the transponder was a non-harmful radioactive chemical which bound itself to an individual's glucose and the middle layers of the epidermis. The telemetric signal was relayed to the redoubt by the ComSat and directed down to the redoubt's hidden antenna array on the mountain peak, which in turn transferred it to the Cerberus computer systems. Bry manipulated the computer's mouse, and the image transmitted from the Vela suddenly dominated the big screen. The view tightened, and more details began to show. A low mountain range broke the far horizon, and a vast rainforest appeared as a sea of undulating greenery surrounding the dark oval of an immense body of water. The banks were crowded with rattan palms and the bone-white trunks of trees. Here and there, on its surface, were the oblong shapes of boats, and what appeared to be villages were scattered along the banks.
Tonle Sap. In the summer, excess water from the Mekong River backs up into the lake, which expands to cover an area larger than Utah's Great Salt Lake. The trees are Palmaceae, cypress, and fromager.
Eyeing the image on the screen, Kane reflected that the jungle appeared to cover thousands of square miles with a brooding wilderness. Kane found the image inexplicably ominous. That sense grew more pronounced when he saw ruins rising above the treetops. He knew instantly the ruins were relics of another forgotten age predating the Nukcost. They thrust jagged pinnacles into the sky from the squarely cut lines of walled enclosures. For many miles, the complex of ruins stretched in a breathtaking sweep of intricately carved esplanades, megalithic walls, and heaps of tumble-down masonry. In the midst of the jungle terrain, the towers rose like the masts of buried sailing ships. The numbers in the measurement window gave the height of the satellite image as 20,000 feet.
The region was known as Phnom Kule. The Angkor Plain was one of the wonders of the pre-dark world.
Leaning over Bri's shoulder, Lakesh worked the keys and the image on the screen changed. The jungle country leaped toward them.
I'll see if we can't get a better shot of Angkor Wat, the most magnificent of the structures.
The perspective on the screen changed, rushing downward through a sky flecked with scraps of white clouds. The plummet halted over a place that was flat and bare, but held a complex of stone buildings in the center of it. The range readout gave the altitude as a little over 5,000 feet. The image was blurred, slightly out of focus, but Kane saw a series of small outlying constructions arranged in a circle around the dark bulk of a larger building. A high wall reared out of the foliage surrounding a looming, sprawling black structure that resembled a half-squashed ziggurat. Shadowy, terraced pinnacles rose from all four corners.
That's a huge place.
Angkor Wat, the summit of Khmer architectural achievement. It's actually a temple tomb erected in the 12th century, built on the foundation of far older structures. Wait, what's going on here?
A shimmering effect, as of heat waves rising from a sun-baked road, seemed to ripple out from the tops of the towers. The shimmer expanded until it seemed to form a canopy over the gargantuan complex. By now, Domi, Dufour, Quavel, and Mariah Falk had all gathered around the monitor screen, gazing at the images with keen interest. Bri reached for the mouse.
Let me try to clean up the picture.
He tapped the button, but the blurry quality seemed to increase.
Other way.
I know how to do this.
Kane caught a suggestion of movement around the structures, of people moving to and fro. Suddenly, shades of bright color bloomed up from the central structure like the petals of an unimaginably huge flower. Whorls of red, white, yellow, green, cyan, blue, and even violet spread out across the ruins, almost as if they were spewed from the towers. The palette of colors almost completely filled the image area of the monitor screen. The picture fluttered, black jagged lines shooting through it. Then it dissolved in a burst of pixels.
Damn it, Donald, what have you done?
Nothing. We lost the signal.
The pattern suggests a burst of electromagnetic radiation. It blinded the satellite.
Lakesh frowned, straightening.
I don't believe I've ever seen anything quite like that before.
Well, the timing seems suspiciously convenient.
I concur. Mr. Bri, give us a playback.
Bri dutifully complied with the request. Lakesh studied the whorls and waves of color spreading up from the structures.
There's definitely a pattern here.
What kind?
What's known in Earth energy studies as cursus, after the Latin for race course.
And what does that mean?
Lakesh still gazed fixedly at the screen.
Sacred architecture around the world is designed to join heaven and earth, as we see in cathedrals, temples, mosques, stupas, pagodas. The great Asian sites of Borobudur in Indonesia and the once magnificent Nalanda University in India are three-dimensional mandalas of the four directions and monumental examples of joining heaven and earth by design.
Geomancy.
Exactly. As a form of study, geomancy has its roots in the Temple of Solomon and was developed by the Greek mystery school teachers over 3,000 years ago. The knowledge and skills were used in the construction of the great cathedrals in Europe during the Middle Ages. It was then regarded as superstition by the church administration, and it all but disappeared.
I thought the whole study of channeling earth energies, ley lines, and so forth was pretty much discredited by physical scientists by the end of the 20th century.
Not so much discredited as reevaluated. The scientists who studied the phenomenon concluded that the ancient observations about grid lines and cursuses were explained to the dominant cultures via myths or scholarly pursuits such as sacred geometry. Ancient knowledge from past civilizations may have seemed like superstition to many people in later civilizations, but is this superstition just logic interpreted by different senses that most people don't use today? As with all specialist studies, they have their experts who contribute much to the understanding of any particular discipline. Lao Tse and Pythagoras immediately spring to mind.
What springs to my mind is what any of this has to do with the disappearance of our people and how we can get them back.
Lakesh gave him a fleeting, jittery smile.
I need some time to collect my thoughts on that matter. If you and friend Grant would care to clean up and rest a bit, perhaps have a bite to eat, then join me back here in an hour. I might be able to offer a few suggestions.
Kane turned on the faucet and a spray of water jetted from the nozzle. He adjusted the shower head to shoot out a needle-like rain. When the water temperature was almost too hot to tolerate, he stepped into the cubicle. He used a liquid soap dispenser affixed to the wall to work a lather all over his body, even making a shampoo of it for his hair. Although his left arm and hip bore black and blue contusions from the bullet strikes, they weren't particularly painful. The bathroom filled quickly with billowing clouds of steam, and he contented himself with luxuriating beneath the driving jets of hot water, letting them soothe the muscle ache. He focused on that, not wanting to think about what might befall Brigid, Philboyd, and Nora. After a few minutes, he adjusted the faucet, and streams of cold, clear water gushed down and rinsed the soap from his body. He watched the water drain away, down into a natural limestone filtration system built under the redoubt. Once it passed through and chemicals leached out, the water was routed back into the complex's water supply. He wished his worries could drain away so easily. Stepping out of the shower, Kane wiped the condensation from the mirror and critically eyed the reflection, staring sullenly back at him. It was a face that had once laughed a lot, had liked carousing with his fellow mags, and had gazed out at the world with prideful eyes. The face had forgotten all those things now, the memories of his youth subsumed by the history of violence scattered all over his lean, long-muscled body. He saw the stellate scars of bullet punctures, the thin and jagged white lines of edged steel that had sliced into his flesh. Turning, he looked at the swirling wheel of a long-ago burn between his shoulder blades. It was from an injury he had sustained in the Black Gobi 2 years before, when he rescued Brigid from the Tushegun's genetic mingler. He had shielded her unconscious body from the mingler's wild energy discharges with his own. Only the tough Kevlar weave coat he'd worn at the time saved his life. Brigid had suffered wounds of her own, far subtler and emotionally devastating. Her exposure to the energy of the mingler and to an unknown wavelength of radiation had rendered her barren. Toweling his hair and face dry, he entered the bedroom and took a pair of jeans and a black T-shirt from the closet. They were articles of pre-dark clothing he had found hermetically sealed in one of the storage rooms. He preferred them to the bodysuits. He tried to maintain a patient, calm manner as he walked around his quarters and dressed, hoping he would actually begin to feel that way. Fear for Brigid's safety filled his mind, and his stomach slipped sideways. He sat on the edge of the bed, breathing deeply, closing his eyes and striving to achieve the mag mind. It was a technique that emptied his consciousness of all non-essentials and allowed his instincts to rise to the fore. He'd been trained to do it while a Cobaltville magistrate and had called on it to handle the pain of injuries or deal with physical exhaustion. But now he couldn't reach it. His concentration was scattered in all directions. Kane wasn't sure if it was due to the nagging pains of the injuries inflicted by the bullets or whether he was simply emotionally drained. When he closed his eyes, he kept seeing Ein Thoroldsen's husband, Vend, lying dead and bloodied on the floor, like a vidtape on continuous replay. Intellectually, he accepted the fact that the young man had given him no choice, but emotionally was a different matter altogether. He struggled with the humiliating knowledge he had been manipulated by Alf Thoroldsen, used as a pawn to carry out a vengeful, vindictive agenda. He couldn't help but wonder how Bridget would have analyzed the situation if she'd been along. He shook his head, battling the tentacles of dread and panic that threatened to engulf his reason. Most of the time he shied away from scrutinizing his feelings for Bridget Baptiste. They were as deep as they were complicated, and the unspoken bond between them was an issue neither one discussed, even after all this time. From the very first time he met her, he was affected by the energy Bridget radiated, a force intangible, yet one that triggered a melancholy longing in his soul. That strange, sad longing only deepened after a bout of jump sickness both of them suffered during a Mattran's jump to Russia. The main symptoms of jump sickness were vivid, almost real hallucinations. He and Bridget had shared the same hallucination, but both knew on a visceral, primal level it hadn't been gateway transit-triggered delirium, but a revelation that they were joined by chains of fate, their destinies linked. Images from that vision spun in the depths of his memory. He saw Baptiste, a beautiful captive, dragged at the stirrup of a Norman lord's horse, and as he tried to cut her free, he was struck down by the bone-shattering fall of a spiked mace. They never spoke of it, though Cain often wondered if that spiritual bond was the primary reason he had sacrificed everything he had attained as a magistrate to save her from execution. The possibility confused him, made him feel defensive and insecure. That insecurity was one reason he always addressed her as Baptiste, almost never by her first name, so as to maintain a certain formal distance between them. But that distance shrank every day. During the op to the British Isles, when Cain had protested to Morrigan that there was nothing between him and Bridget, the Irish telepath had laughed at him.
Oh, yes, there is. Between you two, there is much to forgive, much to understand, much to live through. Always together. She is your Anamkara.
In ancient Gaelic, Cain learned, Anamkara meant soul friend. He wasn't sure if he believed that, but he knew he always felt comfortable with Bridget Baptiste, despite their many quarrels. He was at ease with her in a way that was similar, yet markedly different, than his relationship with Grant. He found her intelligence, her iron resolve, her wellspring of compassion, and the way she had always refused to be intimidated by him, not just stimulating, but inspiring. She was a complete person, her heart, mind, and spirit balanced and demanding of respect. Cain found the thought of losing that person too horrifying to contemplate, not just because of the vacuum she would leave in the Cerberus personnel, but because of the void her absence would leave in his soul. The memory of the kiss he'd given her when they'd taken the jump back in time to the eve of the nuke cost drifted across his mind. It was no surprise that he should remember the kiss, but the intensity of emotion associated with it shook him. He also recalled with startling clarity what the sister Fand of the Third Lost Earth had whispered to him about Bridget Baptiste.
The Lady is your saving grace. Trust the bond that belongs between you. The gift of the Anamkara is strong. She protects you from damnation. She is your credential.
Although most, if not all, the details of his visits to the three parallel planes of reality were now misty fragments, he remembered those words as if they'd been deliberately imprinted in his mind. Cain shook his head furiously to drive out the recollections of the past so he could focus on the present. He had seen Bridget injured before, he argued with himself. She had even gone missing and been imprisoned in the past, but she had always recovered or escaped or been rescued. Bridget Baptiste was one of the toughest human beings he had ever met. For a woman who had been trained to be an academic, an archivist, and had never strayed more than 10 miles from the sheltering walls of Cobaltville, her resiliency and resourcefulness never failed to impress him. Over the past couple of years, she had left her tracks in the most distant and alien of climes and breasted very deep, very dangerous waters. Both he and Bridget had come a very long way, in distances that couldn't be measured in mere miles, from the night of their first meeting in the residential enclaves of Cobaltville. As a 16-year veteran of the Magistrate Division, Cain was accustomed to danger and hardship, but it was nothing compared to what he, Bridget, and Grant had exposed themselves to since their exile. Kane propped his chin on his fist, memory skittering back to a day a little over 2 years ago, when he had sat in the same place and contemplated putting the bore of his sin-eater to his head. Of course, he had been suffering from a severe case of shock, having just escaped Cobaltville, learned the backstory of the nuke cost, and been introduced to Balaam, a representative of the so-called Archon Directorate. His entire life and belief system had been revealed as a lie, a construct, a fabrication. He and Grant were left with two options: die or reinvent themselves. Reinvention of the human identity was something that had never occurred to him before. Like Grant, he had been a magistrate, sanctioned both legally and spiritually to enforce the laws of the barons and arrest the flood tide of chaos by any means necessary. Though he had often entertained doubts about his life path, his identity seemed inviolate. It took him months to understand and finally accept that his identity had derived from his role as a mag, and both were lost to him forever. What took its place was forged in the crucible of horror, life risk, self-discovery, and a commitment to a cause greater than mere physical survival.
2 bits, Domi.
The girl pushed open the door and strolled in, her petite form swathed in a white terrycloth robe. She had made an effort to scrub away the smoke smudges and soot from her face. The angry red streaks of burns showed brightly against her hands and right cheek. They were more unsightly than serious. If not for the pallor of her complexion, they probably would have been barely visible.
Need to talk to you, and my shower isn't working.
Help yourself.
Domi walked in, and after a moment, he heard the sound of a shower.
Hey!
Kane went to the doorway and stood. Domi stepped under the water flowing from the showerhead, picking up a sponge and soap. His eyes took in her compact, perfectly proportioned body. He had never known a woman so unconscious of her body. She had a way of wearing nudity as if it were clothes. Despite the scars marring the pearly perfection of her skin, particularly the one shaped like a starburst on her right shoulder, Domi was beautiful in a wild way. Her body was a liquid, symmetrical flow of curving lines, with small, pert breasts rising to sharp nipples, and a flat, hard-muscled stomach extending down to the flare of her hips. He had seen her naked before. The entire redoubt had, particularly during her first few weeks at Cerberus. The Outlander girl wasn't accustomed to wearing clothes unless temperatures demanded them, and then only the skimpiest concessions to weather, not modesty.
You taking a manta to that Cambodia place?
Yes. Flying there is the most efficient way. Walking around the Pacific seems a little impractical.
You expect Grant to go with you?
Kane blinked at her, realizing that he hadn't thought that far ahead.
I doubt either one of us would fit in the jump seat we installed. I suppose I could ask him if he wants to try it.
Wish you wouldn't.
Why not?
Domi tilted her head back and let the water flow down over her body.
Because you know he'll say yes no matter what.
Yes, I'm sure he will. What else would he do?
Go back to New Edo and Shizuka for a little bit of time. They've been apart for a while now.
They've been apart longer than this before.
Domi stepped out and dried herself with a big bath towel. She shook her head, sighed, and nibbled at her underlip. Her white lashes, looking like pine needles dusted with snow, veiled her eyes.
What?
I got a bad feeling. Something's on the wind. Something nasty on its way. Grant already damn near died saving me from the fire. No point pushing his luck again until he has no choice. He should spend some time with Shizuka, like he was hoping to do when we got back.
Kane eyed her challengingly.
Did he tell you that?
She shrugged into her robe and pushed past him, leaving the bathroom.
Didn't need to. I could tell by how upset he got when Lakesh told him what happened. Take me with you instead.
Kane realized Domi spoke the truth. Grant's reaction to the news of the missing people was definitely extreme for him.
Wouldn't you rather stay here with Lakesh? Haven't you missed him?
Domi gestured in the direction of the command center.
My life, your life, Lakesh's life, is all part of Cerberus. Grant's following a different path now. Not fair to keep pulling him back to Cerberus if he needs to go someplace else. I'll go with you, not him.
He felt surprised by Domi's compassion toward Grant, and experienced a quiver of unease by her readiness to accompany him into dark territory. A year or so ago, during a mission to Utah, he and Domi had shared a room, and she made it clear she wouldn't be averse to sharing more than that with him. He had dashed cold water on her amorous advance by reminding her of her devotion to Grant. That had been the end of it, and he'd never mentioned the incident to anyone, not to Bridget, and certainly not to Grant. Not too long ago on Thunder Isle, after the two of them barely escaped the depredations of a crazed Despletosaurus, Domi had propositioned him. At the time, he had attributed her arousal to a natural jubilation they had survived the Carnosaur's attack. He hadn't followed up on her invitation, if that's what it was. Now he wondered if he should have accepted it. He remembered Domi's wild behavior when she believed Grant had rejected her love in favor of Shizuka. Without Grant as the mitigating influence, the authority figure, what little self-restraint the girl ever practiced was completely discarded. All her bottled-up passions were unleashed, but turned from love to violence. Her shame, her mad desire for a kind of revenge against Grant, had been unbottled during the mission to Area 51 and set in motion a dramatic sequence of events, the fallout of which Cerberus was still dealing with. The presence of the pregnant Quavel was a case in point. Kane presumed that since Domi and Lakesh had entered into an apparently exclusive relationship, she had recovered from her heartbreak over losing Grant to Shizuka and the resentment she had harbored against the man. Although Grant had never treated her badly, certainly never abused her physically or emotionally, she felt she had never earned his respect or his love. Since hoping to one day gain his love was no longer a mitigating influence on her behavior, Domi had, for a couple of months, lost some sense of judgment and given in to her impulses. But Kane also knew the depth of Grant's love for the girl, and the guilt he felt about treating her as less than a fully developed human being, and more as an empty-headed stereotype. In many ways, guilt was the whole foundation of Vill society. For the past 90-plus years, it was beaten into the descendants of the survivors of the New Cost that when Judgment Day arrived, humanity was rightly punished. Therefore, people were encouraged to tolerate, even welcome, a world of unremitting ordeals, conflict, and death, because humanity had ruined the world. Therefore, the punishment was deserved. Love among humans was the hardest bond to break, so people were conditioned to believe that since all humans were intrinsically evil, to love another one was to love evil. That way, all human beings forever remained strangers to one another. In particular, she apparently admired the way Grant and Shizuka were still determined to spend a couple of days together a month, despite their respective duties, which kept them apart most of the time. Until just a few weeks ago, it had been Grant's intent to leave Cerberus altogether and live in the little island monarchy of Nuedo with Shizuka, particularly after the arrival at Cerberus of the Menetius-based personnel and Quavel. But after being captured and tortured by the sadistic Baron Beausoleil, Grant realized the struggle remained essentially the same as it had ever been. There were just new players on the field. The war itself would go on and would never end unless he took an active part in it, regardless of his love for Shizuka and Domi's apparent devotion to Lakesh. The latter, a concept Kane still found a little disconcerting. However, he was in no position to make judgments or even to comment on it. Domi's loves were as tempestuous as her hatreds. Unlike himself, Grant, and Bridget, the only life path Domi abandoned when she joined Cerberus was the marginal existence of an outlander, and later as Guanatigue's sex slave. Kane slipped on his other shoe and stood.
I think you might have a point, Domi. There might not be any real reason for Grant to go with me on this op, even though I'm sure he'll disagree. He'll probably insist on being the one to fly there while I sit it out here.
He's too damn big to sit on. Probably be a good idea not to mention any of this to him until it's too late for him to do anything about it.
Kane returned her smile with a wry one of his own.
Pretty scheming for a little outland girl.
Well, I learned from the best, remember?
Kane knew to whom she referred. He moved toward the door.
Let's go get something to eat.
The massive city walls rose from the plain, looming high with intricately constructed towers. Made of blocks of a green-stained sandstone, Some walls were completely overgrown with flowering vines and huge roots. A few sections were so eroded they had fallen altogether. The great pillars of a gate reared from the underbrush, flanked by three-headed elephants of stone. Beyond them stretched roofless arches and crumbling buildings containing nothing but empty galleries. Everywhere there was sculpture, some of it in low relief, some freestanding and of colossal size, depicting men, women, gods, and bird-headed creatures. Many broken statues lay on the ground, their features screened by the merciless sproutings of the jungle.
What are we looking at, Lakesh?
Images of Angkor Thom, the capital of the Khmer Empire. I pulled these visuals from the database. Obviously, they date back to the 20th century.
Obviously.
She, Grant, Domi, and Kane stood behind Lakesh at the main operations station, watching as more scenes of lichen-encrusted temples and statues passed over the screen. Angkor Thom was enormous, and Kane tried to picture it when it was in its glory, a city blazing splendidly with light and color and bustling with life. But judging by the images downloaded from the database, only brooding silence and the encroaching jungle filled the streets and shattered buildings. Despite the bright sunshine, the city seemed shadowy, dim, with a lost look to it, as though the universe had forgotten about it long ago. Cunningly sculpted reliefs were everywhere the camera panned, allowing glimpses of cavorting, bare-breasted dancing girls, the clash of stone armies and balustrades crafted in the form of seven-headed cobras. A huge building surrounded by carved terraces and galleries appeared. A broad avenue ran inward toward it from the gate. Clusters of square towers rose from all sides, each one bearing stone faces that were foreboding of aspect.
The Bayon Temple. The faces are popularly thought to represent the Buddhist divinity Lokeshvara.
The avenue widened inside the walls, opening into a vast courtyard filled with ruins and tangles of green. Disturbed by the cinematographer, multicolored birds took wing and flapped over great blocks of sandstone and granite that had fallen from the buildings.
I presume that you'll get around to telling us who built the place sooner or later.
The Khmer.
And who the hell are they?
That's a good question, friend Grant. One that was never satisfactorily explained. The only written records of the Khmer culture were put down by one Techeo Takwan, who was in the service of the Emperor of China in 1296 AD. The Khmers have completely disappeared from the face of the earth.
But they left behind legends and myths and all those kinds of fairy tales you love so much.
Lakesh swiveled his chair just enough to favor Kane with a reproachful stare.
Those fairy tales have proved to have their foundation in fact more than once, as you know from first-hand and painful experience.
Point taken. Please proceed.
Lakesh turned to face the screen again and tapped a key. An aerial topographical map appeared in a drop-down window above the image of the overgrown temple.
Modern Cambodia is tucked into a small corner of mainland Southeast Asia, squeezed on the west and north by Thailand and on the east by Vietnam. Its heart is the great Mekong River, whose waters flowing from the north at some times of the year are so great in volume that the channels of the Mekong Delta cannot handle the flow, and the waters back up to the northwest into the great lake of Tonle Sap. In ancient times, this region was inhabited by people speaking an ancestor of the modern Cambodian language. The people and their language had the name Khmer. Little is known about the Khmer in prehistoric times, even as late as the 1st century BC. It seems clear that there were scattered groups in the region, living in tiny cleared pockets of cultivated land on the edges of the floodplains along the major rivers, in the western portion of the Mekong Delta, in the Phnom Penh region, to the northwest of the Great Lake. It was the primary agricultural center of the entire region.
What's all this have to do with our missing people?
Believe it or not, I am getting to that, darlingest one. Because the livelihoods of the early Khmers depended so heavily upon the regularity of the seasons, especially the southwest monsoon that each year from June to November brought the rains that fed their rice crops, the early Khmer were at some pains to attune their lives to the celestial calendar. They worked out a means to measure precisely the duration of the solar year so that farmers would know when to plant. The Khmer lived very close to the lakes and river, in pretty soggy country. Their main communications were along the rivers and streams, in boats large and small, and many of the spirits whom they propitiated were water spirits of one sort or another, especially the Naga, the water serpents. Folk legend traces the very foundation of the country back to the marriage of a foreigner and a female Naga, whose father was the king of a waterlogged country.
Here we go. Serpents, snakes, dragons. This is all going to tie into the goddamn Anunnaki, isn't it?
I thought the Naga were a tribe of serpent worshippers in Assam, not reptile people themselves.
Obviously, they took their name from the Naga myths, like so many other cultures. And, of course, the Naga myths derived from the Anunnaki.
What doesn't?
The Cerberus warriors had contended with the ancient alien reptilian race known as the Anunnaki for quite some time, or at least contended with their descendants, the so-called Archons. Both races were responsible for, or guilty of, influencing most human cultures since before the dawn of recorded history. The Anunnaki were the serpent kings, the dragon lords of Mesopotamian legend. They provided the basis of much culturally diverse ancient folklore in which a godlike reptilian race figured prominently. They established serpents as having special places in most spiritual traditions where they symbolized either good or evil. The Anunnaki came to Earth nearly a 500,000 years before from the planet Nibiru, a world in the solar system, but one that orbited a considerable astronomical distance away from the sun, returning to the vicinity of Earth only once every 3,600 years. A highly developed race with a natural gift for organization, the Anunnaki viewed Earth as a vast treasure trove of natural resources upon which their technology depended. As labor was their scarcest commodity, the Anunnaki's chief scientist, Enki, set about redesigning Earth's primitive inhabitants into models of maximized potentials. The Anunnaki remolded the indigenous protohumans, grading them at rough intellectual levels and classifying them by physique, agility, and dexterity. After much trial and error, a perfect specimen was attained and served as the template for succeeding generations. But during the creation process, a myriad of monstrosities was also birthed, which gave rise to the legends of the Cyclops, the Centaur, and the Giant. The early generations of slave labor were encouraged to breed, so each successive descendant would be superior to the first. The human brain improved, and technical skills grew, along with cogent thoughts and the ability to deal with abstract concepts. After thousands of years, the human slave race rebelled against the Anunnaki, who failed to notice the expansion of cognition on the part of their servants. By the time they did, Earth had become an unprofitable enterprise. Although the Anunnaki were essentially a peaceful people, Enki's cruel half-brother Enlil arranged for a catastrophe to destroy their labor force. The catastrophe was recorded in ancient texts and even cultural memories as the Flood. The Anunnaki departed to their home world of Nibiru, determining to wait for another 3.5 millennia before venturing forth to Earth again. Mariah finally asked her question.
What's the difference between the Naga and the Anunnaki?
Cosmetic, mainly. Like the Anunnaki, the Naga allegedly came from other realms. But unlike them, according to both Hindu and Buddhist lore, the Naga were reputed to be half-human and half-reptile.
Like them Imperial Dragoons we met over in England.
Actually, though it might seem like a singularly unattractive combination, the Naga were supposed to be an extremely handsome race. The Naga maidens were so wise and beautiful that a mortal male counted himself fortunate if she took him for a lover or a husband.
Doesn't much sound like the Anunnaki legends so far.
There are a few disconcerting similarities. Although most Naga were benevolent toward humankind, there were a few who were violently antagonistic. One by the name of Naga Saniya hated humans so much, later generations turned him into the prince of a pantheon of demons. I'm sure that has a familiar ring.
It does. That corresponds roughly with the story of Enlil. Are you saying the Anunnaki built the Khmer Empire?
There's much room for interpretation, friend Kane. According to one version of the myth, a Hindu Brahmin named Kaundinya, armed with a magical bow, appeared one day off the shore of Cambodia. A female Naga, a dragon princess, paddled out to meet him. Kaundinya shot an arrow into her boat. This action frightened the princess into marrying him. Before the marriage, Kaundinya gave her clothes to wear, and her father, the Dragon King, built them a capital city and named the country Cambodia. Cambodia.
Okay, I'm not going to reject the possibility of the Anunnaki having a hand, or claw, in building the damn place, but you still haven't explained how it's relevant to our reason for being here, retrieving our people.
Lakesh manipulated the mouse and the image on the screen vanished to be replaced by a grid schematic. Certain squares glowed red. Luminous straight lines stretched from the red glowing squares, connecting them all in a confusing crisscrossing webwork.
The Khmers loved squares and straight lines in their architecture. They divided their public buildings into hollow squares, sometimes dividing them into a series of smaller squares by cruciform structures. These squares and subsquares are made up of long galleries. Towers were erected at the center, and one at each corner of the larger hollow squares. Each enclosure was terraced, so that each inner square is higher than the one surrounding it, giving the whole thing a resemblance to a pyramid.
He swiveled his chair to expectantly scan the faces of the people around him. After a moment, he looked disappointed.
Do none of you have any idea of where I'm going with this?
Mariah Falk leaned forward, eyes narrowed as she inspected the image on the screen.
The entire city complex, when each of the sites are connected, forms a huge mandala.
Exactly. And does that mean anything to any of you?
Kane resisted the urge to glance over at Grant to see if the word meant anything to him. Then he repressed the much stronger urge to tell Lakesh in very profane language to knock off the academic performance and get to the point.
Shit.
What?
I said shit, as in it means shit to me, and to the rest of us too. Wasting our time here, Lakesh.
Yeah, just tell us what a mandala is supposed to be so we can get on with whatever we're here to get on with.
Mandalas are symbols that are used as a potent means of altering consciousness, especially by practitioners of Buddhist Tantra. Mandalas are usually divided into four quadrants, but the entire image represents the palace of the central deity of the universe. Angkor was built according to these principles. All of its monuments and temples have encoded in them a message or a recognition of a different kind of reality, an awareness based on knowing how we make our life passage in this universe, and the insights and enlightened states of mind that come about as a result of paying attention to the spiritual journey of our souls.
Mariah frowned.
Lakesh, at first I thought I knew where you were going with this, but now you've lost me completely.
He never had me.
A mandala is also an esoteric method of focusing and generating energy. What kind of energy were we discussing only an hour ago?
Electromagnetic. So?
Earth energies. You're talking about ley lines, aren't you?
Yes. Finally, now we're on the same page.
Before any of them could dispute his claim or opine that it was premature, Lakesh returned his attention to the keyboard.
Ley lines is the term applied to a vast network of straight lines connecting power points or sacred places of the ancient landscape. All of you know my belief about people throughout prehistoric times mapping the energy in these lines and citing their monuments at intersection points. I postulate that the ancient Khmer built Angkor Thom to interact with the high earth energies in the region. They existed in a cause and effect relationship with it. Most of the buildings are erected upon convergences of the ley lines. The entire plane is a hub of geomagnetic energy.
That sounds like sheer straw-grasping speculation to me.
Lakesh smiled.
Straw-grasping I might be guilty of, but I dispute your claim of sheer speculation. Astronomically, all the structures have built-in positions for lunar and solar observation. The sun itself was so important to the builders of the temples that solar movement regulates the position of the bas-reliefs. It is not surprising that Angkor integrates astronomy, the calendar, and religion, since the priest architects who constructed the temple conceived of all three as a unity. To the ancient Khmers, astronomy was a sacred science.
As it was to any number of cultures, from the Mayans to the Sumerians.
Indeed. The expression of calendrical, astronomical, and cosmological themes within the dimensions of Angkor raises an important question. Was this purely a Cambodian innovation, or had Angkor's architects learned of the practice from an even earlier source representing a tradition that was practiced elsewhere?
like the Naga or the Anunnaki. Could the Khmers have learned the art of geomancy from them, too?
Perhaps. I'm playing back the satellite transmission right before we lost the telemetry. I've slowed it down considerably, as you can see, and I've run it through a thermal line scan filter to pick up energy signatures.
Kane and Grant stepped forward, watching the familiar events unfold again on the screen. With the speed of the sequence slowed, they were able to make out more details of the temple Lakesh called Angkor Wat. It almost looked as if it had been carved out of a single crag of rock that broke the flatness of the tableland on which it stood. All of the visible surfaces were covered with a multitude of intricate carvings and frescoes and squatting stone giants. The tapering tops of the towers took the form of lotus buds. Low down at their base, they saw openings where pale lights glimmered. They could see now people moving about the buildings.
Here we go.
A shimmering haze, more like a barely visible distortion, suddenly emanated from the tops of the towers, seeming to spring from one to another. Even with the speed of the playback slowed to a fraction of real time, the motion was so fast they barely caught it. At normal transmission speed, the phenomenon was too quick to be seen with the unaided eye. As they watched, the distortion expanded, making sweeping pirouettes back and forth and around the pinnacles. It fluctuated, stretched, almost appearing to tremble. Then it fanned, forming a semi-opaque tent with the towers serving as pegs. At the center of the energy pattern, a great swirling whirl arose, like a maelstrom. It bulged upward as if it were a membrane being pushed from below. It gushed into the sky, and the image on the screen broke up as it had the first time.